Welcome to Claret in Conversation, a podcast of voices from the creative industry. Here, we explain voices about how we ended up where we ended up, and we share great works of art that inspired us and that we, in turn, create. These are our first few episodes, and we're really pleased that we've had the opportunity to come together. My name is Katie Espester, and I'm the editor and publisher behind Claret Press and Clapham Publishing Services. Today we're very happy to welcome Michael Coolwood, an author, a male author, who writes predominantly feminist science fiction and fantasy novels. Most, such as the recently released steampunk murder mystery Drown the Witch and the comedy of errors Confessions of a Gentleman Arachnid, are informed by his experience of living with depression, anxiety, and fatigue. He is also a short story writer, who one of his short stories was shortlisted for an award with the MMDA Claret Press short story competition and was included in the collection of short stories that came from that competition called Insights 15 Stories Exploring Disability. So welcome, Michael, to this fantastic little podcast we've got going for just exactly like people like you who make their living cobbling together, selling stories.
It's a great pleasure to be here. The intro was very nice. It sounds great when someone else says it. When my internal monologue says exactly that same thing, it just sounds much less impressive. I think I might need to chop this bit out of the podcast and play it to myself occasionally to stay motivated.
We were talking about that with a number of creative artists. This is a theme that runs through the creative industry, creative producers. And one of the reasons why I created this podcast is I think we're so isolated. We're so by ourselves, reaching out to each other through social media. And you end up being filled with self-doubt and confusion and even loneliness.
Absolutely. It made me very happy that we live in the age of social media. Social media, I think, has a lot of problems with it, especially the ones we're seeing now.
Yes, of course. Yeah.
But with creative people, it can be a real boon. I'm on a Facebook group that's set up by one of my editors that has led to a lot of reinforcing positivity. But that wasn't always the case when it first started. Mm-hmm. Another editor was on there, and they were saying a lot of things that were very important for people to hear about how difficult it can be to get along and the importance of going along to events and self-selling. But it came across as quite dispiriting and reinforcing the things that authors already have in their heads that you're not going to be successful and you may as well give up.
Yeah, it grinds you down. Grinds you down. Yeah. You know, Michael, I can't help but notice that you're a male author who writes predominantly feminist fiction.
Yes.
How did that happen?
When I was a student, I watched a lot of stand-up comedy and watched a lot of television. Stand-up comedy from people like Ed Byrne, television comedy like Futurama and Coupling. Futurama, the famous cartoon, and Coupling, the TV comedy by Stephen Moffat. And when I went back and rewatched some of those and re-listened to some of those a few years later, there are things that stood out about how attitudes had changed towards homosexuality, towards gender roles, and so on. And it made me twitch a little bit. So I started widening my scope. I started listening to the Guilty Feminist podcast.
Oh, yes. I have to admit.
And my then girlfriend, now wife, has always been quite loud and outspoken. Exactly.
Speaking as someone who is not known for her reticence, I think the world's a better place if we have more of us out there. I'm glad to hear that.
But regarding the feminism, that her outspokenness actually sort of held her back on her feminism journey a little, because she's always not had a problem with yelling at people if she got catcalled, for example. Mm-hmm. It took her a little while to...
She's a stand-up comic, then.
No, she's just loud. I'm not even really sure why. I think we both got bullied quite badly at school. Yeah. And so there are a couple of responses to that. One, which I took, is to turn in on yourself and sort of try and take up as least space as possible. Whereas hers was to expand a lot and to go, I am here, it doesn't matter what you think of me.
Yeah, which bring it on.
Yeah, exactly. Bring it on. Yeah. But it led to her thinking, feeling that other women must behave in more or less the same way, and it took her a while to empathize with those who didn't feel like they could turn around and yell at the people who were catcalling.
Yeah, and take on the world.
Yeah, exactly. So we started off down this journey at around about the same time, weirdly, and we're expanding our reading and watching and trying to bring in other types of voices into how we lived our lives, and that informed my creativity, which was your question.
No, you got it on quite nicely.
Yeah. So when I started reading, so I read English at university and then had a massive gap in my reading because I was fed up with reading, frankly. And then I started reading science fiction and fantasy. And the more science fiction and fantasy I read, the more I noticed this pattern of there is precisely one female character per book, usually.
Yes.
And far too often, their introductions would go like this. Simon walks into the room and the crew were splayed out before him. They were all staring his attention. There was man number one who was chisel-jawed and slightly stubbly. There was man number two who had a gun strapped to his back. There was woman, only woman, who had her uniform unzipped to her navel and had done her hair this morning. And then back to the men who had all the important jobs. They all do this.
That's fairly accurate. Fairly accurate.
That's so annoying.
Although I don't think Robin Hobbs, she's a science fiction fantasy writer, and she's got strong female characters.
So Anne Leckie is another. Yep. Anne Leckie's books are so good. Becky Chambers, who does Long Way to a Small Angry Planet, she's got really good. So yeah, there are one or two. A decent slice of the science fiction and fantasy industry.
But they're still a minority.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I watch a lot of Japanese cartoons because they use very different storytelling to what I'm used to in the West. But you have to have a very keen, I have to have a very keen, my feminism radar of, okay, that's three shots of the women's breasts in a space of about 5 minutes. No, moving on.
Yeah.
Because Japan has even more of a weird thing about sex and sexuality than we do in Britain. And we're quite odd.
Let me just respond at two levels to what you say. One is that I totally understand the perspective when you talk about your wife struggling with not understanding why women can't take on the world. My mother is a bit like that, and actually having very little time for feminism as a result. It's kind of, you got a problem, you solve it.
Yeah.
End of. Take no prisoners, no holds barred. And yet she's smart, she's hardworking, she's and a caring, decent, wonderful person. But as a kind of modus operandi, it's tough to create a political movement around take no prisoners, no holds barred.
Sure.
And in fairness, as the world, as she has gotten older, she's appreciated that some problems aren't solvable that way. That you can't be a lone ranger. Are we mixing metaphors here?
I think it's been consistent, at least.
Yeah, a consistent mix.
Sure, yeah.
But I was also going to suggest that one of the problems that has held women back is that the women who have been successful have not known how they've done it in spite of the odds. They haven't, not because they've necessarily been able to work the system. So they tend not to mentor as much as one might have thought.
There's a problem which I have heard about, which it involves not sending the ladder back down, because oftentimes women who succeed, they buy into the boys' club ideology rather than changing.
Well, they think, I didn't need any help. Why do you?
Exactly.
Nobody mentored me. Why should I mentor you?
So if we look at Theresa May, our current prime minister for now, she has no women in the cabinet. The leader of the House of Commons. I don't know if that's the cabinet. Yes. She has a very, very small number of women in her government. Yeah. The Labour Party are doing a little bit better, but not by much.
Mm-hmm.
They have a senior woman in the shadow cabinet, who's Diane Abbott, and a couple of other senior women, including Dawn Butler and Jess Phillips. But we've been having women in politics for a long time now. We should be seeing far more, but there are a lot of systems that are set up to not prevent women getting in exactly, but facilitate men to the point where women are always swimming upstream, essentially.
And how does this consciousness, this awareness that you've got, how has that moved into your writing?
Mainly by switching up the number of characters that I introduce as female and introduce as male, switching up the roles. So my protagonists are now always female. That wasn't always the case. My second book had a male protagonist, but that was because I was always doing the Jeeves and Wooster thing. Now it's always female, and so that changes the dynamics of the other characters that get involved. And so most of the other characters I include as women as well, which changes how things are seen. There's a lot more friendships between women, which you don't really see in science fiction and fantasy that much. But again, in Becky Chambers' Long Way to Small Angry Planet, it's a rare example where there are three women on a spaceship and a few men. But everyone's really good friends, and there's a romance blooms, but it just seems like a very positive work environment. But that's Becky. Whereas a lot of science fiction and fantasy focuses on being quite dark, quite grim, and so there's no place for healthy interactions.
Sure, look at Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. Game of Thrones, there's also this young adult fantasy series I was reading called Throne of Glass.
Oh, yes, I've read Throne of Glass as well.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So that's trying to do a very similar sort of thing to Game of Thrones, I understand.
It's more lovey, more romantic-y.
Yeah,
more,
exactly.
So, more Mills and Booney, as far as I was concerned.
The romance was what stopped me reading the second book.
Yes, me too, actually, I have to admit.
I made it through the first book and thought bits of it are really good, really awesome. It's written very compellingly. It keeps me going. But the romance is just... hunky boys making big eyes at the protagonist just made me go, no, I'm fine, thanks. But she's got this really nice friendship with the princess that's hanging around in the same castle that she's in. And they're kind of equals to a certain extent, but it's never explored to my satisfaction because she spends so much time focusing on this romance angle where she's hanging around with the boys. So in my writing, I try to focus more on different character types, different ways people interact, but focusing on relationships women have with each other and that women have with men that aren't necessarily about smushing genitals together. That is a horrible turn of phrase, I apologize.
But it beats spit swapping.
Oh, yes. That's pretty bad as well.
Yeah. This whole issue of gender relations, I think it doesn't just... it's not just in literature. I think literature reflects, books reflect, storytelling reflects our reality around us. And I find it astonishing the extent to which novels have not adequately reflected friendship among women like you've just described, as if this is somehow a bizarre phenomenon that so few women have. And yet the vast majority of women I know not only have female friends, they've got a lot of female friends, and yet it doesn't seem to show up in our storytelling enough. And now, of course, to complicate matters, we've got this new phenomenon that's kind of recently erupted into the mainstream social awareness of transgendered people. And that's absolutely not in our novels. Do you think that's going to be coming, Michael?
Definitely. I have a few transgender friends, so one of my challenges for the latest book that's come out, Drowned Witch, was to have a transgender character included, but it's a murder mystery. And in a murder mystery, you have villains and you have deviants, because they're the ones who have secrets to hide, and you have other suspects. And once you don't want to have the transgender person being the villain, because that is
played out
really badly. You don't want to have him being a sexual deviant, because that's a negative stereotype. It's also really bad.
Yes.
And so
Silence of the Lambs.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Silence of the Lambs. And Psycho? I don't know. I haven't seen it. Anyway.
Yeah, and Psycho. You're right. I've forgotten about Psycho.
So I was left with precisely one character who I could actually include as transgender. But that I ran it past two of my friends and they said it was just about okay. But I want to do that again better. But yeah, I love novels. I think they're a really great format. You can tell a massive variety of stories with them. But one of my main criticisms at the science fiction fantasy, particularly industry as a whole, is a failure to innovate. Our fantasy is mainly, not always, but mainly stuck in sort of Tolkien-esque medieval
Europe. Yes, of course. Yeah.
And when it comes to science
fiction...
It's a bad
stereotype, isn't it?
Yes. It's been played out. So the Polish author Andrzej Sapkowski, who wrote the Witcher novels, did a very similar sort of thing. It's still medieval Europe, there you go. But because it's not stories that I personally am familiar with, it's all based around Polish folklore, it felt so much more fresh. It has its own problems because it's a Polish novel written in the 1990s, yes. And so its representation of women is pretty bad.
Yeah.
But it's still has this element of newness and innovation, which I thought was really refreshing. So when it comes to, I feel that the representation of friendship, the lack of matriarchal figures, if there are parents in fantasy, they're either dead or male.
And one of the things that always annoys me is that when they simply replace the what would have been a young man or a boy, and they just simply replace it with a butt-kicking girl.
Yeah, you can't.
And you think, that's not good enough. And it's exactly the same phenomenon.
Yeah.
You know, there's... And you don't actually get any sense of this being it's like an Uber person, you know, without it being a generic human being as opposed to someone female.
That has been described to me as the Ms. Pac-Man effect, where you take a male character and put a bow on it and boom, done. I was about to clap. I'm not going to do that. You're absolutely right. If we go back to Throne of Glass slightly, that I think could have that got so close to that problem where the main character was the most amazing assassin on the planet despite being 17. No, she wasn't. Her age was that, and it made me want to beat my head on the table. But she avoided being just a boy character turned into a girl character.
In fairness, you've got a good point. Mm. You know, Sarah Moss is the name of the author. Just remembered her name.
Yes.
And in fairness, the female protagonist of the Throne of Glass series is genuinely female.
Yeah. She is interested in... she cares about the clothes she's wearing. She is a prodigious pianist, which is something boys are never allowed to be, which I find quite interesting.
Yes, and that's something else. Mm. Yeah.
And her relationship with the boys, as much as it slowed down my awesome fantasy about assassins, was appropriately teenage and did feel like a relationship between a teenage girl and two teenage boys.
Yeah.
Because no one knows what they want.
And you know, I wonder just we're on this topic, and I mean, we've gone seriously off piste, but you know, it's such an interesting topic that let's stay with it. One of my complaints about the Harry Potter series, for instance, is that here we have a woman who has written something for children in which the lead character, she, by her own admission, the character of Hermione, the bookworm, was her. She said that's what she was like at school. And you're not surprised when you discover that. You hear that she knew every answer to every question before the teacher had finished saying it. And she spent her summer holidays, you know, reading all the literature in advance. And you think, oh, yeah, that'd be you, JK, absolutely. But it's still kind of sad that in this day and age, she had to make the lead character a boy,
very
Harry Potter. And she had to call herself by her initials. She's not Joanne, she's JK. And you kind of think, oh. And yet no one would ever criticize JK Rowling of being anybody's doormat. So I wonder to what extent it is that we just accept unthinking, not you obviously, but the rest of us just accept the fact that we are going to get two-thirds of the adventure figures are going to be male, and the always have to kind of suck that one up.
It's something you have to make a... So even now, when I have been taking this policy of really thinking about what the genders of my characters are going to be, even now I still just default to everyone being male if I'm not paying attention.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think another character that really broke that apart was Katniss Everdeen from Hunger Games, because she, again, was genuinely female.
Yeah.
And persuasively so. Was that a male or female author who wrote
Suzanne
that?
Collins, I think.
Yeah, Suzanne Collins, that's right. So a woman, yeah, which is good to know.
Katniss Everdeen makes me so happy as a character. I think she's awesome. She's genuinely flawed. Her backstory informs her talents. So
it all makes sense, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. She's a poacher, which makes sense that she can set traps, and she's an archer, but then that's where her talents stop. So she has to learn while she's in the arena in the Hunger Games. And it means that she can, but her empathy lens means that she makes friends in the arena, which boys wouldn't necessarily have done.
I love
Hunger Games.
Yeah, I thought the Hunger Games was a superb book, and also an interesting book because it's about storytelling.
Yeah.
How do we tell stories? And to what extent do we massage a story that so it comes out the right way, so it has the right amount of drama in it?
Absolutely.
You know, so when they're being, in the arena and she's getting advice from her coach. It's like, can you kiss the boy? And she's like, oh, for Pete's sake. It's like, do I have to? And it's like, do you want to win this or not? You know, like kiss the boy. And it's like, she doesn't want to lie. She wants to be authentic. She wants to be true. But it's like, you're engaged in trying to attract people's attention and their sympathy. So, you know, just massage the story here a bit.
It lended some sections that could have been quite monotonous, some really interesting dynamics, and it changed the interplay between Katniss and Peter really well.
Yeah.
And it meant that we really missed it, or at least I really missed it, in the third book when those dynamics were taken away. Mm-hmm. In The Hunger Game, in the last book, when they're infiltrating the Capitol, it's just a series of combat encounters, yes, to use role-playing game terminology. All that interesting stuff was taken out, and suddenly it was a lot less interesting.
Yeah, I agree with you. It was all about twists and turns. Mm, exactly. Yeah. Okay, so now we've gone seriously off piece. Let's bring us back, and I was going to ask you just bluntly now. Tell us if there's any creative works that really inspired you when you were young and helped to encourage you to go along the route that you're in now.
When I was young, it was mainly Asterix. So, but
Asterix, woohoo! Love Asterix.
Good old Asterix.
But did you read them in English or French?
Oh, English. My French wasn't good enough at that time.
Oh, well, we had to read them in French in Canada.
Oh, very cool.
Not so much. I couldn't get any of the jokes.
What fascinated me about Asterix was how the translation took out a load of French jokes and inserted a load of English jokes.
Yes.
They must have had so much freedom with that translation.
Anyway. Yeah, the translator for Asterix are actually quite famous. Like the dog in French is called Idéfix, and in English it is called Dogmatix.
Yes.
Which I just think is a wonderful piece of translation and an improvement on the French.
Mm.
But they're justifiably famous.
Yes. When I got back into reading in 2009, one of the books that got me back in was the Hunger Games trilogy. We've done that. Very nice. The other two were The Player of Games by Ian M. Banks and The Half-Made World by Felix Gilman. Super quickly, the Ian M. Banks book should be familiar to those that know him. It's about a far future civilization, and they encounter a different civilization and try to do diplomatic efforts by playing this massive sprawling game that this other civilization indulge in, which is so complicated that people can spend entire lifetimes learning, and it ends up, the protagonist ends up playing as if he's representing his own culture, whilst the other civilizations start playing as if they're representing their own culture, which has very different systems of values, and the other culture gets really angry because they're playing the game wrong. They're supposed to play to win rather than have this wonderful cultural mix. So cool. The Half-Made World was a game, a book actually.
And that Ian M. Banks' ability to raise interesting questions. And that one of the things that, and we see this in, again, going back to women, I'm just thinking about women, is the extent to which there are unstated norms that underlie all games.
Yes.
So, for instance, politics. You know, that I'm thinking right now about Canada. The Prime Minister of Canada is probably going to go down because the women are resigning from his cabinet due to the fact that they're not playing the same game by the rules as they are.
Sure.
And it outrages not just liberals, but men. It's like, well, this is what happens when you put women in positions of power. They quit for no good reason. And the women are saying things like, well, I didn't like that, what was happening and going on to my friends. And it's just like, what, so you're bringing the government down because of this?
That's kind of awesome.
Yeah, so it's complete, these norms, and you can't write them down. When you do write them down, they're not accurate. Mm-hmm. They underlie so much of what we do.
The same thing happened in Birmingham. They brought in equal pay laws, and the council realised that they had been paying a load of their female staff a lot lower than the male, so they bumped the women up, and then the council was suddenly in financial trouble because they couldn't afford to pay everyone a proper rate. And so a load of men were like, wow, you see, it's the women bringing the council claim. They shouldn't have rocked the boat and been asked to pay the same amount. What do they get off doing that?
It's just very interesting. So he raised that point that anyways, he's a good writer too, Ian M. Banks.
The imagination on display is amazing. Two books, The Bridge and The Wasp Factory.
The Wasp Factory in particular, I think, was fantastic.
Yeah. The other one was this Half-Made World thing. The story is less important, but in the setting, three factions are caught in the middle, normal humans. humans who have sold their soul to demonically possessed firearms and humans who work in this semi-communist industrial civilization where everyone is being brainwashed by sentient trains.
Trains. Like, as in choo-choo?
Yep, those things. So once I read those three sets of books, I couldn't then go back to reading books set in the real world because everything seemed really boring. Go, yeah, but where are my sentient trains?
I have to check that one out. Sentient. I love the kind of the extraordinary creativity of that. I think it's fantastic.
It's very cool.
Yeah. And so that made you rethink not just your reading, but maybe bits of your life?
It made me want to write.
Excellent.
And yes, I was having some trouble with work at the time, and Jen and I had just moved back to London from Birmingham. And so it made me, both of us really wanted to re-engage with some of the creativity we'd both had when we were at university, and shortly after we became good friends because we were making short films at university. And so having read these amazing books, it just made me want to do something myself.
Fantastic. Now, you're writing the short story I'm familiar with that got published by Claret Press, The Inspector and Denouement? No, Depression and Denouement.
That's one.
It's quite overt in the fact that the lead character, which is I should just tell everybody, it's like a takeoff of Agatha Christie. So you've got a murder mystery in a house, and it's the inspector comes in and has a constable, doesn't he? Isn't a constable?
Yeah, constable depression.
Yeah, constable depression, who just undermines every single thing the inspector's trying to do. So the inspector's trying to find who killed the character in a kind of like a kind of Cluedo Agatha Christie type way, and all the way through it, constable depression is just tying him up in knots so that he's barely able to do anything. It's funny, it's touching, it's very insightful for what it must be like to grapple with depression and still function at any kind of a level at all. And which, of course, why it was shortlisted for an award, because it was such an innovative way of presenting this horrible disease that clearly you've been struggling this with yourself, Michael.
That's right. I have had depression for as long as I can remember. Really, it probably kicked in around the age of 14, along with anxiety. Fatigue came along at some point, but I've only just worked out, as in about 6 months ago, worked out what was going on there. It's probably a secondary symptom of the depression.
Okay.
But I've always known about it sort of as tied up in the massive ball of depression. So just to briefly summarize, the depression is characterized by a consistently low mood or sadness, but it's quite deep, very hard to get out of, which leads to lethargy and feelings of self-blame, self-worth. Along that with comes thoughts of worthlessness, occasional suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts, and other bits and pieces, overeating, undereating, oversleeping, undersleeping. Anxiety is tightness in the chest, at least I experience. Irrational fear that you can't do a whole lot about. Occasional panic attacks on my end. And fatigue is just overwhelming mental tiredness. So I do a decent amount of exercise per day. If I was having physical
tiredness.
Yeah,
you look quite fit, I have to say.
I'm doing decently.
Yeah, yeah.
I was having trouble thanks to the depression. I had a food problem a few years ago where I was just mainlining chocolate, and I actually managed to slip into the obese end of the BMI, and I then got a dog, which meant that I was doing an hour's walk a day, and that cleared that up very nicely.
Yeah.
But I also have had to stop eating chocolate. I've not had any chocolate now for 3 years.
Sugar, or just chocolate?
No, just chocolate. The other sugar is bad, but it's not as bad as the chocolate. Okay. The chocolate was so bad.
And how does the depression, this sounds like something that you have to live with day in, day out, year in, year out.
Pretty much. So for the majority of my life, depression would come in 2 or 3 month patches, and then it would go away for a bit and then it would come back. When I only finally went to the doctor when I had a patch of 3 months and then 4 months and then 5 months, and it just didn't stop. And then I started taking the medication, and then it took me about 2 years to find a medication that worked for me. So since 2014, I think it was, it's been pretty much constant. But thanks to therapy and medication, it's a lot more manageable now. I'm on a drug trial where I take two antidepressants at the same time, lefepramine and lithium, if you're interested. And I'm having psychotherapy, just came from psychotherapy, actually, which is doing a lot of good work.
Excellent. I'm really glad to hear that, Michael.
Thank you.
Because this is just strikes me as being just a punishment that nobody needs. Like this is just so unfair. I just, you know, my heart goes out to you.
Oh, thank you.
This is just rotten.
It's tricky because you can do things about it, which is nice. It takes a lot of energy and a lot of work. So I consider myself more fortunate than people who have conditions that are completely out of control and that have a very negative track, very negative prognosis. The prognosis for depression, unless it's really bad, if you have the if you live in a country where they give you free drugs, it's great. And if you live in a borough where they can provide you with psychotherapy, then that's also great. If you live in, for example, the US, where you have to pay for your healthcare, that must be a lot worse. In Canada, it's probably okay.
Yeah, we've got we don't have any private healthcare in Canada.
Yeah.
Medicine you have to pay for.
Oh, sure.
So it's a complicated mixture, completely idiosyncratic.
The worry in Canada, because y'all have just legalized cannabis. Cannabis is great, in my opinion. But for depression, used in moderation, it can really help. Used frequently, it can make things worse. So the worry is that some people will use it will not realize that they had depression. It took me so long to notice what's going on. I should come back to that.
Yeah, but let's deal with it right now.
Yeah, sure.
So how could you... With all due, and yeah, I'm so sorry if these questions are rude. Don't mean to be. How could you not know you were depressed?
It didn't occur to me.
You were sad. You were. You think? Oh, is this so normal for you? You thought everybody was like you.
No. So right. Okay. The best example is for my panic attacks. I've had panic attacks since a very young age, but I didn't realize what they were until until just one day, 2-3 years ago. I had heard people describe them multiple times. I just had not made the connection between what happens to me and what a panic attack is. But it was just something that happened to me. So with depression, the depression thing is a slightly different because I had these periods where I was just really upset and really sad and couldn't do anything. But I hadn't made the connection to anything wider. I hadn't seen it as a pattern. And if I used the word depression about myself, that would have indicated that I accepted there was a problem. Whereas if I refused to use the word depression, I pretended everything was fine, then I thought the problem would just go away. It was just a one-off event.
I see. Yeah. It's like getting the flu. It doesn't mean that you're chronically ill.
Yeah.
It just means you got the flu. How did all this affect your writing, Michael?
I think it's made it stronger. Because it's the treatments I've been taking for this has made me more empathetic and made me consider emotion more. So I'm much more interested when a car blows up next to the protagonist. I'm mm-hmm. more interested in how they're reacting and how it makes them feel than I am about having them chase down the person that blew it up.
Interesting. So it's actually changed your storytelling then?
I think so. Previously I was interested in story at the expense of almost everything else, so my characterization suffered badly.
Yes.
What I wrote was just a series of things happening one after another, basically. So it's definitely changed the way I write.
Interesting. And what would you say would be the greatest, the work of art that you're most proud of having created?
Currently it's Drown the Witch, which is the novel that's just been come out. I think the one I'm writing at the moment is a little bit stronger, but it's hard to tell because it's not finished yet.
Say the name again, please.
The name for one that's just come out is Drown the Witch.
Drown the Witch.
That's my steampunk murder mystery.
Can you give us an elevator pitch for it?
Yes, it's a steampunk murder mystery with witches, hence the name.
That's a great elevator pitch. You know, 10 words or less. There it was, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. That's how I've been describing
to people. I almost feel like counting them up. It's a steampunk. Steampunk is one word, right?
It's hyphenated, but
steampunk murder mystery with witches, hence the title.
Yep.
Eight. Nah. You can even do two more words in there.
I'll think about what those two words are.
And what is that that's made you so proud of this?
It's a young adult fantasy novel with interesting characters that goes into contemporary issues whilst maintaining a good deal of escapism. So the main character starts off, is infiltrating the secret society, and she is going around constantly with this other person who has a demonic face and horns growing out of the top of her head, who can evaporate water or cause it to explode. And so she's terrified of this person.
Yeah, fair enough.
But throughout the novel, she gets to know this person a lot more and learns that this person is terrified of humanity, because if a human sees her unveiled face, the humans will just descend on her and execute her on the spot, probably as some sort of horrible abomination.
Mm-hmm.
It goes into a lot of things about fear of the others, and it then dives into some immigration stuff.
And how do we get a hold of this novel, Michael?
It's available on Amazon and Audible. The Audible version is read by a narrator called Soame Capilla, who is really good. I was absolutely thrilled that she did such a good job. So I personally would recommend the audiobook novel, but yeah, if you want the print version, that's also available on Amazon.
Michael, it's been a very great pleasure to have you today. I genuinely wish you the very best, not just with your writing, but you know, with everything. I hope it goes well for you, and I hope this new trial, this drug trial that you're on, I hope it works out well, and you weren't part of the control group. You got the real McCoy.
Thanks very much, and I hope to work with Claret Press in the future.
I do too. Yeah. Thank you for joining us for the first season of Claret in Conversation. I hope you've enjoyed it. I've certainly enjoyed it. I've learned an awful lot about people and their various activities. And one of the things that has surprised me the most is the extent to which all our lives have overlapped or reflected in each other, the drives, the needs, the problems, the frustrations. So it's been very insightful at many levels, as long as it's been just a pure pleasure. I hope to see all of you for our next season, which should be broadcast in a few months. Until then, goodbye. Make sure you rate, review, and subscribe to this podcast. And follow us on Facebook or subscribe to our newsletter to keep up with the latest news, events, and podcast updates. The newsletter is available through our Claret Press website or our Clapham Publishing Services website. Claret in Conversation is hosted by myself, Katie. It's produced by Alex Holmes and edited and engineered by Chelsea Moore. We've had additional assistance from Hugo Zhang.